Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens. My co-host is Pat Foreman, author of City Chicks, Chicken Tractor, and other great titles. Today is Thursday, July 26th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and, of course, living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
You have the chickens, the coop, and the run, but do you have the egg cartons? Don't put your beautiful farm fresh eggs in any old used grocery store egg carton. Impress your friends with your very own custom labeled egg cartons from eggcartons.com. They have a large selection of custom egg cartons, stamps, and labels to choose from. Pick out your new custom egg cartons at eggcartons.com. That's eggcartons.com. First State Vet Supply is your one-stop shop to keep your birds healthy and happy. They have a wide selection of medications, vaccines, vitamins, wormers, and much more. Every product comes with specific directions and doses for your small backyard flock. Have questions about a sick or injured chicken? Take advantage of First State Vet Supply's Ask the Chicken Doctor program. For just $25, you can have a personal phone consultation with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. The consultation fee is waived if you purchase a product from First State Vet Supply. Visit them online at firststatevetsupply.com. That's firststatevetsupply.com.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer. If you're in the market for a new incubator, then look no further than GQF. They have a great selection of tabletop and cabinet-style incubators at prices you can afford. I love my GQF Genesis Model 1588. It has a large picture window and an automatic thermostat, which makes for a better hatch every time. Go pick out your new incubator at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com. Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We were had a little technical glitch, nothing with Blog Talk Radio today, a little technical glitch in my brain. It's kind of like I remember a long time ago, my dad had his own architectural firm. He did a lifetime long. He's long times retired. But one of his workers came in and said, sorry I'm late, I had car problems. And my dad said, what was the problem? And he said, I wasn't in it soon enough this morning to get here on time. So kind of that thing. Technical glitch today was that I just had a brain technical glitch and forgot to reschedule the show from 12 to 11. But that's okay. I realized the mistake in time, got it pushed back to 11:30 anyway. So not a problem. We are all live here now, and life is good, I can assure you. So very quickly, what I'm going to do is eliminate a lot of the host chat. We'll do that a little bit later. We'll talk about the chicken coop contest, the chicken coop we're giving away tomorrow. We'll talk about that a little bit later since we're limited on time. And our guest, special guest today, is a little limited on time. We got a great topic. Let me first, because I'm looking at the switchboard and I see co-host Pat Foreman is on and available. So let me first and foremost introduce my wonderful co-host, poultry advocate, and of course, author herself. Herself of many great titles, it of course, would be the lovely and the one and only, of course, Pat Foreman. Hey, Pat, good to see you.
Hey, Whisper, I know it's been a long time, it seems. How was your vacation and the rest of your tour?
It was very, very good.
It was awesome.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about yesterday on yesterday's show. We were down in Savannah yesterday, arrived home late yesterday evening back at the homestead. And, of course, that's always crazy, laundry and getting everything back in gear. And you got the garden to tend with and neighbors coming to say hello and things like that. But it's been a little hectic, but it went fabulous. And we'll catch everybody up with all the details of that and other things that are also going on that have the potential to be very, very exciting stuff. So I'm glad that you had can join us today. But because we've got limited time with our special guest today, Richard Frudenberger, mm-hmm. publisher of Back Home Magazine, and it's a great topic. Everybody wants to learn more. A few months ago, we had a great topic and a very popular show about cooking with cast iron. And so not totally related to that, but today the topic is cooking with Dutch ovens, or Dutch oven cooking, I should say. Mm-hmm. So without further ado, let me go ahead and we'll get right to our special guest today. Pardon me, Richard Frudenberger. Welcome, Richard.
Yeah, how are you doing, Andy? It's a great introduction.
Welcome, Richard.
Yeah, hi, Pat. So we'll jump right in, I guess. Might as well set the stage right here. Yeah, we did a couple of months ago, I think, or some weeks ago, we did talk about cast iron cooking skillets and care and feeding of cast iron and all that good stuff. And this is definitely related because, as far as I'm concerned anyway, the only correct Dutch oven is a cast iron Dutch oven.
Oh, yeah.
And so we do have a lot of information on that. We have had contributors in the past who have really given us some good articles on this, and there's people on staff, of course, do their own research, and maybe not all of us, but I myself and I know other people use cast iron on a pretty regular basis. So it's really a good product, or a good good way to cook for a couple of reasons, but we'll get into that as we discuss it. Dutch oven, I guess a little history is in order, and I found out something that I really never knew before. I had just assumed that the Dutch oven came to the U.S. from either Dutch or German immigrants, but that's not actually the case. They were developed in the Netherlands, but I am almost going to go on a limb here without having researched it further. I'm going to almost say that probably was even probably the Belgians, because the Belgians have had casting. They have iron ore, and they have done a lot of casting and metal fabrication in their little country, and I'm sure the Netherlands has as well. But anyway, apparently it actually, the whole Dutch oven use in America, here in North America, was actually started by an Englishman who was in the Netherlands and observed them casting and making these Dutch ovens for their own use. And as quite enterprising as they can be, he went home and patented the idea as his own and started selling Dutch ovens to the colonists at that point and under his own patent. So that's a little factoid I never knew, but yes, they are. If anyone's not familiar, I can't imagine that, but they're those tub-like cast iron pots, very tall. Well, not extremely tall, like a not like a big kettle tall, but it's a good 3-4 inches tall pot, if not more. Usually with the little legs on it. They don't all have legs, or they can be had with or without the little stubby legs. But the only kind I ever was that interested in was the kind with the legs. And of course, it has a lid and the and a little bale handle, like a thick wire handle that swings straight up or swings right and left and can be folded down against the bottom of the side of the of the oven itself. I have seen Dutch ovens made of aluminum. I've seen them made of other material, steel with a ceramic coating, whatever. But for reasons that I probably can't even substantiate, other than the traditional ones are just black cast iron with good tight-fitting lids and a wire bale, those are the ones I like, and those are the ones we're going to talk about, because that's pretty much what we get when we get submissions on this subject, and especially in the summertime when you're talking about camping and Dutch oven cooking and all that. That's what they're sending pictures of, and that's what people are using. So the deal is that they come in different sizes. That's another good thing, and there's a reason for that, and we'll discuss that later. But they you can get a 12 inch oven. There are 14 inch ovens, and there may be some other sizes too. But the point is to get the kind with the three stubby legs on the bottom, because they're more universal, they're more usable. I happen to have an old Griswold flat-bottomed cast iron Dutch oven that was my mother's, and I believe it was her my grandma's before that, but it doesn't have the legs on it. That is what we always made our Sunday stews on, or she always made our Sunday stews on, or Saturday evening, whatever. If they were going to do that, we put it on the stove, and it would cook for seemed like hours. But mm-hmm. it was made to go on the stove on the burner. However, when I inherited that, I got to the point of thinking, gee, if anything ever happened to this, I'd really be heartbroken. So I don't use that one as much. I went out and bought another one. There's only one U.S. manufacturer of cast iron that I'm aware of. So I bought that one, and I bought the one with the little legs on it, the three little stubby legs. And the reason is that having a gas range, now if you have a flat top range, or you have, an electric range, I guess an electric range would work if the eye was small enough. As long as those legs will fit, as long as that electric element is high enough above the surface of the stove that the legs don't interfere with the stove, although if they did, I guess it would still work, although the electric element should really be touching the bottom of the stove, of the pot, or the oven, I guess. But for people with gas ranges, which is what a lot of people have, those three legs are usually, since they're equilaterally set around the bottom rim of the oven, you can set that oven in such a way that you'll always find a way to set it right down on the iron, I guess, I don't know what you call that thing you take off, it's over the burner, that thing that holds the pots up. It'll always work, twisted one way or the other, the legs are always going to be able to fit around that, so the oven can fit right on top of that cast iron or stamped steel rack, or whatever you want to call it, that holds the pot up above the burner. So if you buy a legged Dutch oven cooking, you'll have the best of both worlds. One you can use on the oven, and one you can use on the campfire if you want to do that, which I would advise at least doing it once, because once you do it once, you'll probably do it more than once. Well, it's really that good. I mean, the food, it does have to be tended, and you do have to sort of keep after it a little bit, but it's well worth it. Just to finish the historical stuff, I mean, these Dutch oven things were carried by people going west, and even when a lot of people settled along the coast in those days, going west meant western Pennsylvania, but even so, you know, they carried them with, that was their main oven, and that was it. And, of course, in those days, they used wood, you know, wood for firing it. And you could hang it up by its little bale handle. You could hang it up on a stick or on an iron hook above the fire, or you could lay it right down on the coals. It's not going to hurt it. They're made to be put right in the coals. And, in fact, if people are familiar with the Dutch oven, you just take a mental note of it, think about it. There's the lid, of course, but the lid has a rim around the edge of it, usually about half an inch high, if not a little more. It's usually rounded a little bit, and it has a rim right around the edge. Well, that rim is to hold the coals in or to hold wood on. So when you actually set it on fire, or those coals are white hot, they are contained on top within that lid rim, and so you've got heat both from the bottom coming up into the pot and from the top going down into the food in the oven, and it being a well-sealed rim between the lid and the oven itself, the heat's going to stay in there, and that's the secret. So the coals aren't going to hurt it. And this little tidbit here, and this person, Catherine Lugo, who wrote this article for us in the last issue, actually July issue, said that the Dutch ovens were so held so valuable that it was not uncommon to find people willing them onto their relatives upon their death. Like, for example, George Washington's mother willed her iron kitchen furniture, is what she called it, to her nephew. I don't know why George didn't get it, but I guess her nephew got it. So, you know, that's it's almost like in those days, you know, nails were held in high esteem, and people would, mm-hmm. if they were moving on, they would sometimes burn the houses down just to collect their nails as they went westward and carry them with, because they needed, you know, it wasn't that easy to, you couldn't really make them on your spot, you know. So the Dutch oven is its own dog, so to speak. I mean, it's not quite like the other skillets and all the other Dutch all the other cast iron things. It has its own specific purpose. So we'll talk about the few items here in looking for a Dutch oven, whether it's a used one or a classic heritage style, you know, the old Griswolds or Pittsburghs or some of those old-time ones, very highly desirable and collectible, or whether you get the new, you know, the new Lodge manufacturing, the new ones are, you know, I've had one for years and years, and I really like it. I mean, it's been great for me, and it really... You know, compared to the price of some of the really old stuff, it's a bargain, the newer stuff. So mm-hmm. What you want to do is, as I said, get the kind that, whether it's the 12-inch one or the bigger one, get the kind with the stubby legs on the bottom. So usually it's three legs because three is self-balancing. You want to make sure the lid is a good fit. Now, casting a piece of iron is not a science. I mean, it's a craft, it's a skill. It's a factory-made thing. You know, they are hand-set, I understand, but you know, each one comes out a little different. So there may be a fit difference. Some of them already fit really well. I mean, there's no gaps between all the way around the rim. The lid should fit tightly onto its base, and you can look around the whole thing and see if there's not a good fit. You can look for another one, you know, probably have a couple of them in the store, or you can, if the fit's not that bad, if it's close but it's not perfect, you can actually take some valve grinding compound, which is actually an automotive thing. You can buy it at the automotive supply stores or places like that where they service automotive machine shops and workers' materials. It's a very abrasive paste, and you can rub that on the rim of the oven, and then just twist that lid back and forth until that it'll actually grind away the metal until the high points will be ground down, and it'll let that lid meet its face in a much smoother way. Obviously, a lot easier to just pick a good one to begin with. And that's, you know, it's not that I'm sure the factories check for quality control, but I'm sure that there's a certain tolerance below which, you know, obviously a real serious problem is not acceptable, but I'm sure they allow a little bit of leeway, and if you're fussy, you can, you know, you probably just want to pick one that's, in good shape. Although I shouldn't say it's bad just because there's a gap there, but you can fix the gap if you want to be fussy about it. The metal casting should be the same thickness all the way around. That's both the lid. Look at the lid at the edge, and then more importantly, the tub itself, the oven itself. it should not vary thin to thick in the walls of the oven itself. Now, you really can't do much about the base because you can't really see it. I mean, if you had a micrometer or a caliper, you could measure it, but that's going a little far. However, if there's an issue with the sides, there's probably an issue with the bottom, too. So you want to select one that has an even thickness of metal all the way around the walls of the thing, and you can look, the oven itself. You can look at it from the top and see if there's a variance. You want to make sure the lid has a good grippable handle on it. You know, some of the important stuff is sort of economy, and you know, maybe it's cheaper, but you need these features. You need to have a handle on the lid itself with a hole in it. You have to get a hook into it or get your padded fingers into it, your gloved fingers into it. So you want a nice big handle on the lid, and then you also want a wire handle. Absolutely critical to have a wire handle on the oven itself, a good strong wire handle with the two loops where it attaches to the oven, and that wire handle swings freely back and forth so it can lay on the right side, the left side, or straight up and down. A lot of the better units will have a little nubs cast into where the handles fit in so that the lids will stand up straight without you having to hold it, and then just a little pressure, it'll go right or left, you know, without a problem. So you want, as I said, you also want to just decide how you're going to be using it. There's, as I said, there's 12-inch models, there's 14-inch models, and there may be some other sizes too. But you know, if you're not really sure, or if you have problems with lifting weight or whatever with that kind of thing, you might want to start with a smaller one. I myself have a bigger one, but you know, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to change the taste of the food. It's just going to allow you to make more food in one, you know, in one sitting. So if you have feed a larger family on a regular basis, you probably want the bigger one. If you just have one or two people, then you might just want the smaller one. The difference in price is probably not that much. So I'm going to go over a little bit about the first use of a new oven. Basically, back to the cast iron talk. You know, it comes new from the factory with a coating, a protective coating of wax, or sometimes they use an oil. You really don't want to cook in that. You want to remove that stuff before you actually start cooking. That's really just for protective, to keep the iron from rusting when they ship it, and it sits in the store for, you know, might be in there for, you know, quite a time. Mm-hmm. So they just protect it. They don't want it to look bad. You open it up and there's, you know, rust all over the place. So they coat it with oil or wax. What you'll need to do is give it a good hot. This is probably the only time, or at least one of the few times, you're going to actually put soap into the thing. You want as hot a water as you can stand, and some just regular dishwashing soap, and just scrub all that oil or wax out of there. The lid's going to have it, the inside of the tub's going to have it, the outside, everything's going to have it. So you're going to have to get rid of that oil, and use a plastic scrubbing pad. That's important. Those plastic, I don't know if they're called Shore Boys, not the metal kind, but the plastic or nylon. It's the best to use, really. It doesn't scratch the metal, and it will remove. It's abrasive, but it's not scratchy. So that and a little bit of soap will take care of that. As soon as you finish your cleansing job, whatever you want to dry that oven and the lid as quickly and thoroughly as possible. So I do it. Admittedly, I waste a little extra energy, but I do turn the stove on low, and I set the when I'm drying, I usually set the, even though I've let the water out of the thing and the tub is still dry and the lid is still moist, I will put it on a flame just to bring it up to enough heat to get all the moisture out of it. You don't really need to do that, but you can also put it in a warm oven. If you have been cooking already and the oven's still warm, you can dry off the oven with a towel and then put the oven and the lid in the range oven, and the heat from there will dry out the material. But the idea is not to let any standing water or even moisture reside in the cast iron tub, because it's going to either rust or just leave a funky, you know, leave like a mildewy type of residue, and you just really don't want that. Again, the soap is only that one time. Later, like if you buy used equipment and it's rusted, or if there has been damage or some improper use or care of the oven, or any cast iron for that matter, on down the road, there are situations where you may have to re-scrub and go through the whole process of seasoning the oven again, and I'll go through that real quick because that's important. This is going to be a non-stick permanent coating, or at least permanent until you need to rewash it again. When I say wash it, I mean rescrub it with soap. But if you normally, if you use the oven or even a cast iron skillet, and you rinse it with hot water and no soap, and then dry it out, will not remove the seasoning coating. That seasoning coating is going to stay with that piece of cast iron for quite a long time if you take care of it. And as I said, you may have to re-season it and re-scrub it at some point through its lifetime, but, you know, that's not something that needs to be done that frequently. To season the oven or a piece of cast iron correctly, what you want to do is once it's dry and cleaned of all that, if it's new, you want to clean it of all that, as I said, wax and that oil, as I just described. Then you want to grease the inside and outside of the oven, the lid, the oven, the bottom, the top of the lid, the whole shooting match, everything, with either canola or vegetable oil, but you do not want to use anything with salt in it. So that eliminates like lards and butters and margarines that have salt in it. You just do not want to use salt. Get the salt out of there. It's basically just the canola or vegetable oil that doesn't have salt in it. And you want to get that oven to a warm temperature, you know, 190 degrees, 200 degrees. Get the vegetable oil in there, and that's going to allow it to absorb into the pores of the metal when it's warm. That's why we're warming it up first. You may have to wear, some kind of glove or mitts or whatever, so you don't want to burn your fingers. But you will be taking a fine cotton cloth or just paper towels and just rub that oil or canola oil or vegetable oil all around inside the oven, outside the oven, the lid, the whole deal. And at this point, then you're going to bake the whole thing, the oven, the lid and the oven itself, in your range oven at a temperature of a minimum of 350 degrees up to 450 degrees for at least an hour. You just want it's going to smoke like the dickens, but that's okay. What you do want to do is line the bottom of the oven with a tray or a pan, because that oil is going to get hot and it's going to start dripping off there, and if you don't put a lining down there that you can easily remove, you might want to just cover the lining with tin foil and just throw that out. But if you don't put something under there, you're going to have drippings all over the bottom of your oven, so you may not want that. So it's easier to just take precautions. But you want to cook that iron in that coated iron in the oven for, you know, like I said, 350, 400, 450 degrees for a good solid hour, if not more. It is going to smoke. If you have smoke alarms, disable them. Open the doors.
Some of us use the smoke detector as a cooking timer. So
that's how it works. But yeah, you want to open the windows. You want to turn on the exhaust fan. You know, that kind of thing.
the smoke alarm goes off.
Very funny.
The casserole must be done.
yeah, that's right. That's basically it. Yeah. But, you know, it's going to smoke and it's going to drip. But once you've gone through your hour or more, if you can stand it that long, you want to withdraw that thing with gloves from the oven, and you wipe out any pooled oil that may have existed in the bottom of the pan there, or the bottom of the oven, the tub of the oven, of the iron oven, and remove that, and then just let it sit and cool. It'll get, of course it's hot, and it'll cool down, and it'll eventually just be warm so you can actually handle it. And then you want to put another thin coat of canola or vegetable oil on there and let it bake again, because that's going to cover any of the pores that didn't get filled in the first session will definitely get filled in the second session. And so we just go through the whole thing one more time, and it'll also lay another layer of what I call permanent coating, because it really is, unless you either scrape it out with a metal utensil or wash it out with soap, it's going to stay there, for quite a while. You're building up every time you're cooking, because the Dutch oven cooking does tend to involve a lot of oils and whatever, you know, things that will basically re-coat and re-season. Well, I probably shouldn't say re-season, but it'll re-coat that coating that's already existing. It'll just reinforce that. And so every time you cook, it's just building up another layer of protection. And that's, essentially what we're, why it's such a great utensil, because it's always ready to go. And it does not, I mean, it doesn't peel off like Teflon does. It doesn't, you know, if that does happen, if you have to scrape it with your with a steel utensil or with a spoon, and that does happen. So if you don't, if you're not careful, you can, you know, it's not permanent damage. You can scrape the coating off. You just have to reseason it, and that's not the end of the world. And real briefly, if you happen to have rescued older cast iron from a yard sale or from a flea market or something that does have rust in it, you'll just want to scrub that out, scour it out with a fine grade sandpaper. I've had utensils that I bought for a few bucks to see a real bargain. Sometimes you see a good American made older cast iron piece, and people just don't realize because it's rusted. Maybe they think it's bad. They just don't realize that it has a lot more value than a few bucks. And you know, I pick it up, buy it, you know, and I have put a wire brush on the end of my drill, like a conical brush, and just wire brushed it out for the really, really bad rusted areas. But for the most part, you really be able to use a fine sandpaper and just get all that down smooth to the metal, and then you can season it as I just described. So you know, that's the way to go about it. I mean, you it's iron. You're really not going to hurt it. Now, there are ways to hurt it, and actually that's sort of the end of things, but I'll let you, at this point, it's probably a good time to mention it. You can hurt it by dunking it, when it's hot, dunking it in cold water. It will almost certainly warp or even crack if you do that. That is absolutely the worst thing you can do. Do not put cold water on a warm or a hot Dutch oven. You do not want to let the oven or any iron utensil sit in water for any length of time. You will rinse it in hot water when you clean it, but you will not let it soak. Let anything soak in it or let it soak in the sink for hours or overnight or anything like that. That's not the way to do that. You do not put it in the dishwasher wet and let it sit there and get to it later, and that's not how to do it. You got to deal with it right then after the meal. You really don't want to use soap on it except in the extreme situation I described the first time, and then anytime you're reseasoning it, going through the whole process, that's when you use soap. Other than that, it's just the hottest water you can stand to rinse it out after your meal, and then a plastic scrubby or a chore boy brush or whatever, as long as it's a nylon or plastic type scrub brush that with no soap on it, that's all you really need to get the bad particles out, and then rinse it with hot water. It'll remove all the food. It actually looks great once you've done that, and then dry it carefully. If it takes a little heat to dry it, that's fine, but just dry it, and then you're all set to go for the next time. Let me see. Don't put the Dutch oven empty over a hot fire or a hotbed of coals without something in it, because that has a tendency to warp the metal. It could also possibly crack it. So make sure there's something in it before you put it on an existing fire. And the other thing is, when it's heating up, even if it's empty, if it happens to be empty in heating it, like if you were heating it to maybe dry it out or in preparing food, but I would always again suggest, unless the recipe calls for heating the pan first, which I really there might be a few like that, but for the Dutch oven there probably isn't. You don't want to turn high heat immediately on to a cold Dutch oven. Like if you retrieve your Dutch oven from the shelf or wherever you store it, and then you put it on the stove and turn the stove range up to high, that's not what you want to do. You want to start it on the lowest heat possible and just let the heat build up. Dutch oven cooking is not particularly convenient in the sense of convenience, but it's energy saving, and it's definitely a good way to cook. So you'll have to, there's some sacrifices you're going to have to make. That one of them is that it does take a little more time to build the heat up slowly. That's number one. And number two, you do have to take a little more time to clean the utensil after you've used it, but it's not awful long time. It's just, you know, a few minutes really at both ends, you know, before and after. So that's it. And that's basically your care and feeding part. And, you know, none of those rules are really that difficult to remember. But
we have
a question
in the chat room just popped up. What's the best way to clean the outside of a cast iron Dutch oven when it gets crusty?
Well, that's not going to hurt anything. I mean, essentially, what I would do is just rub off with that plastic. Those plastic things are like 79 to 98 cents in the store.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't scrape it off with a. I assume this person is talking about like, you know, meal after meal. If you're using it outside and whatever, I would just scrape off the excess crust with a you know, an abrasive pad like that, but not a metal one, and just sort of let it go at that. You know, it doesn't have to look good. If you want it to look good, you're going to have to go through the whole, you know, the whole washing process, and you really don't want to do that over and over and over. It gets old after a while. I mean, the whole process gets, you know, you get tired of it. If you're re-seasoning it constantly, you're really not doing it right. I would just maybe dedicate that crusty one to the outdoor cooking. That's the outdoor one. And if you want to do a lot of indoor cooking, just get another one and use that for your indoor and just do it that way. But yeah, the outside crust can be removed or the majority of it with just an abrasive pad. That's really well, I think that's probably the best, you know, best thing. Let me see the is there anything else that I was going to move on to. Let's see some others. Oh yeah, spatulas. That's just in the use of it. You know, people can use metal. You can use metal utensils, but you really have to be careful. So I would suggest. I've learned to use a Teflon or a plastic spatula, and I'm really comfortable with it. So if you use plastic wood or Teflon utensils, you're going to have zero or almost zero risk of ruining the inside coating or the seasoning coating of the inside of the oven. So I would sort of stick with those. If you absolutely have to use metal, I would just be really careful not to scrape the bottom or the sides of the pan as you're working. But that is sort of difficult. So, you know, I think sticking with plastic wood or Teflon-coated utensils like spatula spoons and other kinds of things like that is going to be your best bet. What you're going to need in addition to that kind of utensil, other thing, especially with the, you know, with the outdoor cooking, is you're going to need leather gloves, like welding gloves. You can for the indoor stuff, you can use the pads, you know, the kind of mitts, but you really don't have a lot of control of your fingers with the mitts. So if especially with the outdoor cooking, since you're going to be maneuvering the pot a lot more and you're going to be dealing with being able to manipulate things, you really need to get a pair of either very heavy leather gloves or typical welder's gloves, which really aren't that expensive in the long run. They last forever, and they're nice and heavy, so you don't burn yourself. So that's that. You'll need to get some kind of lifter for the lid. It might be a hook. It might be a utensil made just for that, just a handle that has a little hook on the end of it that you usually they're just made of like steel rod or something like that. But wherever you buy that pot, you'll probably buy the lifter itself, and they're not expensive. A lid holder, that's more like a rack or some kind of a jerry-rigged metal or hook or something that's going to be right alongside the campfire to hold the lid while you need someplace to set the lid aside while you're dealing with the food. So, you know, in some camp situations, if you're there for the whole weekend and you want to set it, people will set all this stuff up beforehand. You have your little rack, you have your stanchion with all your tools there, and, you know, the fire's ready to go and all that stuff. So that makes it a lot easier. But other than that, you're still going to have to have some place to put your lid, even though it may be a big rock or something, just some place to put it so you're not setting it down the dirt, you know, with your cooking. Tongs, that's always a good thing. Long-handled tongs, some of those really long barbecue-type tongs. You're going to need to maneuver coals around, pick them up, drop them down in the right place, you know, that kind of thing. So you know, the long-handled ones are better because you're going to have less of a chance of burning yourself with the heat from the fire. And the tongs themselves are not, they don't need to be that expensive. I've seen in the dollar stores or the economy kinds of places, I've seen some cheap long-handled tongs for, you know, really, really very little money. I mean, a lot less than you think. They may not be great ones, but being metal, they'll probably last a while. And the other thing is a small shovel, like a spade, a really small type of fireplace-type shovel or camp shovel, entrenching tool, like an ex-military, you know, one of the entrenching tools, or something with just a small spade-shaped digger end on it, and a handle. It doesn't have to be a long handle. You'll be needing to move and bury charcoal and ashes around and dig a little pit, that kind of thing. So that's good. So you got you know, four or five, six tools there that you might, that are also, you can borrow from other uses that are just really good to use. So I guess I'll get on to the formulas. Actually, there actually mm-hmm. is a formula for cooking in Dutch oven, outdoor cooking. This involves just if you're cooking outside with charcoal. So we have charcoal briquettes. That's the most common way of cooking with these things. And there's actually a formula for how many briquettes you're going to use, for depending on the size of the stove, size of the oven that you have. The 12-inch ovens, these are basically formulas used to keep maintenance of the temperature that you want, say between 325 and 350, depending on the size of the stove. So if you have a 12-inch oven, in order to keep your temperature in a range of a good cooking range, you know, 335, 350, whatever, you're going to need to put 9 charcoal briquettes on the bottom of the oven as you set it down, and you want to put 15 of them on the top. If you're using a bigger oven, the 14-inch oven, you're going to have 17 coals on the top and 11 on the bottom. And the reason is the ones on the bottom are going to let the heat go into the food from the bottom. There doesn't need to be as many of them because it's not going to lose as much heat from the bottom. On the top, it's going to have a tendency to lose heat more quickly, so you'll need more coals to keep the heat maintained. The formula is, if you haven't figured it out already, you take the size of the oven, you add 3 for the top, so it's 15 on top, and you subtract 3 for the bottom. So if you have a 12-inch oven, you add 3, that's 15 on the top, and you subtract 3, 9 for the bottom.
I can't believe there's a formula. That's crazy.
Yeah, there actually is. I mean, that's a good starting formula. I should say a starting formula, because you may find that it gets, probably not get too hot, but it may get too hot, or it may not get hot enough, so you'll want to adjust that. You'll find through experience that you may want to adjust the temperature accordingly by either adding or subtracting briquettes. Also, the wind, the temperature outside. If some people like to go out in late fall and do their hunting and cooking. The weather's going to be cooler, or just in a windy environment, it will tend to remove the heat from the oven more quickly. So you may have to add coals to increase the temperature. The other thing is, if you're cooking liquids, whatever, you're going to want to put more. It'll have a tendency to allow you stews and such with liquid cooking inside. It's going to require more cooking from the bottom than the top. So you're going to put up to 2/3 of your quantity of coals down on the bottom and less on top, because you need that heat coming from the bottom to actually make that stew cook through. So you want, of course, just like you're cooking out or in the grill, you want to get your charcoal briquettes up and going. They may not have to be white hot when you start, but you want to get them going and get sure they're going to be turning red and getting in the edges getting into white. It's going to take about 15 minutes or so to get them going before you put your oven on there. And what you're going to do is arrange them in a circle in the oven. Now, some people will actually dig a little pit for the oven. That's actually a good idea. Dig a little pit larger than the oven and put your coals in the pit, arrange them in a circle, and then place, of course, you light them, and then place your oven right down on top of those coals. You don't want that pit too big, because you want the heat to be maintained within the pit. When I say a pit, I don't mean to bury the oven. I mean just, you might want to dig it a couple inches down to the ground and flatten the bottom so the coals can have a place to rest flat. And you don't want to arrange those coals any in a circle that's any larger than about half an inch perimeter, within half an inch of the perimeter of the outside of whatever size the oven is that you're using. So if you have a 14-inch Dutch oven, you'll want to arrange those things. The bottom of the oven, of course, is going to be smaller than the top. So you want to arrange those things so the coals are in such a way that they do not extend. They do extend within half an inch of the outside perimeter of the bottom of the oven. So that's pretty easy to figure out. Just do it slightly less than whatever the oven's bottom diameter is. And then you want to put the lid on, and then lay the top briquettes evenly around onto the top of the oven. So whatever it takes to just spread them around evenly. So you don't want to pile them all in the center or pile them all around the edges. You want even cooking requires even heat distribution. So you just want to keep them out there nice and flat and level or nice and even. And then what will happen is during the cooking process, you will be lifting and rotating the oven about a quarter turn every 15 minutes because that'll help. That will help distribute. If the heat will probably be uneven, no matter how careful you are in doing it. And I know people who do this all the time will probably correctly say, I know I do a good job, so I don't have to rotate it. And maybe in their case they don't, but I will suggest to most people just rotate that oven because the heat will be distributed more evenly that way. If you didn't quite get it right in arranging the coals, or the coals do heat at a little different rates and whatever, when you rotate that oven by using that bale handle, a quarter turn every 15 minutes, you're going to be distributing the heat evenly throughout the whole cooking utensil over, you know, the hour or so that you're going to be cooking, so or more, you know, that you're going to be cooking. So that's important. And then you'll also be rotating the lid in the opposite direction, a quarter turn, when you're doing your rotating. So the lid goes one way and the oven goes the other way, and the rotation does done about every 15 minutes, and just, you know, that'll pretty much assure that the heat will be distributed evenly throughout the cooking process. And that's really the secret to good ingredients and good cooking, is that the heat is distributed evenly. That's, you don't really want hot spots, because what that's going to do is it's going to overcook certain parts of the food, and then it's going to undercook other parts. You certainly don't want that. So, you know, that's, if you distributed the heat evenly, it's just going to work much better. So we're talking about meats, potatoes, vegetables. You can cook cobblers in there, you know, pies and dessert dishes, cakes and bread and whatever. But as I said before, the liquid is going to need more heat on the bottom, so you're going to put about 2/3 of your coals on the bottom, and then 1/3 on the top. And with the other, some of the other things, certain meat dishes, the potatoes, and any of the other stuff I mentioned, you'll have more the lion's share or the majority of the coals on the top, and maybe 1/3 on the bottom. So, you know, that's the secret in maintaining the difference between the liquid mm-hmm. and stews and that kind of thing, and everything else. And the other thing, especially with the baking dishes, and I'll go through a few recipes here, but with the baking stuff,
awesome.
You may want to remove the, in fact, it may be necessary to remove the oven from the coals at a point about 2/3 or 3/4 from the end of its timed sequence. So in other words, if the recipe says, you know, an hour, you want to remove it maybe 45 minutes or a little less. If it says 20 minutes, you know, accordingly. So, that's the deal. And it's really quite simple. And it's also sort of fun. I mean, you're camping. I even find it at home, especially in the winter, I guess it's hardwired into us. When the weather gets cold, it goes from the fun summer to the more serious winter, and you realize, hey, I'm going to have to heat myself. You know, this whole winter, I got to make sure that wood's out there. It's very reinforcing and comforting to know that you have food to cook, and to cook it, those stews and those heavier meats and the potatoes and all those great carrots and all that good high protein or high carb stuff. That real comfort food. You know, you are one with the food. I mean, it's like you're participating. You're not just pop in the microwave and walk back 7 minutes later. I mean, it's like you're every couple of minutes you're in there with a stirrer, and you're maybe turning the oven this way or that, looking in there, making sure there's not too much water, making sure there is enough water. You know, you want to add other seasonings later on through the recipe, you can do that, and it smells great. And you know, and the other thing is these recipes on the inside on the stovetop don't require those high temperatures that people sometimes get used to overcooking their food. That's one of the real problems with a lot of people these days who aren't real tuned into cooking and cuisine. They want to overcook everything or overflame everything. I guess you should be saying that. The Dutch oven doesn't require, once it's heated, it doesn't require, the maintenance heat isn't as great, so you're really saving energy to maintain the same temperature within the oven, because that thing is sealed, it's holding the heat in, it's a thick wall, it's an absorptive iron casting that absorbs the heat and holds it, so you really don't need to be feeding as much heat into it, and you're still maintaining the correct temperatures inside it. So that's really the mm-hmm. you know, one big key to the stuff here. And the other key, I might as well just mention,
sure.
That's the other energy saving key. With other things, other types of utensils, whatever it is, aluminum or whatever, you tend to be scraping and scrubbing, and the water's running, and you know, or you're putting it in the dishwasher. You don't really want to put a cast iron in the dishwasher. Thank you.
Right.
So you're basically, you're just rinsing. It's a quick, hot rinse. It does require hot water, but it's a very quick, hot rinse, a real quick swipe with that scrubber, and you're done. You're not using that much energy. I know when I'm trying to get it out of the Teflon pan, and, you know, of course, my Teflon stuff is older, and, you know, it is at the point where I don't care if I scrape the Teflon. I mean, Teflon's pretty much, it's not gone to the point where it's exposed and it's flaked off or all that, but it's almost not, I mean, it's older, so I will be a little less careful when I'm maintaining it. And you might be running it under hot water, and, you know, more than just a minute or so. And so you're wasting water, you're using water, you're taking longer to clean it. The cast iron, you don't need to do that. So it's, you know, that's the other energy saving aspect of it. So it's both during the using and the cleaning that you're saving the energy. So that's, you know, that's just an important factor to remember. The other thing is with the cast iron, you're generally cooking more food than you need to eat at one time, unless you're cooking for a larger group of people. So what I'll do is I'll make a stew or something, and I'll make food for one or two people, and then you can freeze the rest of it. And so you've made your meal then for the, you know, next whatever weeks down the road, you've frozen it, and so you don't have to do it every time, you know. So it's that's always a good little, you know, secret. But let me, unless there's some questions in the chat room, mm-hmm. I can go over a couple recipes. And
that sounds
so
great.
Covered. Okay, I want to check the time here to make sure. Yeah, we're in good shape. I'm a little bit pressed for time today.
Yes,
only,
yes.
So
we're
set though. Let me look here. I'm going to get some couple good things. We got a baked bean. We got a breakfast here. We've got pizza. We got cobbler. Let me see. Oh, actually, here, I didn't know this. Here's my ignorance, because I only have the 8, the 12, and the 14-inch. There actually are 8-inch ovens. There's 10-inch ovens, and there's 12 and 14. So I didn't know they made that little wee one. I guess that's good for individual servings. But so apparently, and I really, I'll be honest with you, I have not looked through the Lodge catalog. I pretty mm-hmm. much see what's in the store, and I know what's there. But I guess there's a catalog or an online place you can look. But I assume that they probably make the smaller ones as well. But you know, I know in the flea markets and whatever, there's a whole variation of size of a lot of different cast iron. Some of these little teeny things that you never, but I guess they're for individuals. You really find it hard to get your spatula in there. But they've made all that different sizes. So. But let's get on to the recipes. Here's a Mountain Man breakfast recipe. It involves bacon and onions and mushrooms and peppers. It sounds like a yummy omelet without the omelet part. So you got a pound of bacon. You get your pencils out, right? Pound of bacon, two medium yellow onions you dice up, 1.5 cups of diced fresh bulk mushrooms, one green bell pepper, diced up, 3 cloves of garlic that you mince up, 12 medium-sized potatoes, and I prefer the red ones, you know, those reddish, the little
mm-hmm.
small
yeah.
red ones. You can also use the Yukons, the yellow ones, or, I mean, you really could just use, you know, use anything, really, but I really like those thinner-skinned ones for the breakfast meals. They really sit real well with me, the yellow and or red. And 12 eggs, 12 beaten yellow eggs, salt and pepper as you need to, and then 3 cups of grated cheddar cheese. Maybe you want to put a little picante sauce in there. If you like it hot, more. If you don't like it so hot, just a little bit. You want to heat the 12. This is for a 12-inch Dutch oven. You heat it. You know, heat it first, low heat. Cut the bacon into 1-inch slices and fry it in the oven, right in the bottom of the oven, until into 1-inch lengths. I'm saying, cut it and fry it in the oven until it's brown and, you know, cooked. Then you throw in your onion, your diced onions, it's minced garlic and diced onions. The mushrooms are diced, the bell peppers diced, and the garlic, and saute it in the bacon fat and whatever until the onions are translucent. That's a typical thing, so you actually can sort of see through them. Then you'll add the potatoes, and you want to season it with salt and pepper, and that'll be covered and baked for 30 minutes. You season the eggs with the salt and pepper, and then you pour them over the potatoes, and then cover it and bake it another 20 minutes, stirring them so it's really a scrambled, stirred-type dish, stirring everything gently for about 5 minutes. When the eggs are done, you put the cheese on it and replace the lid of the oven and let that stand until the cheese is melted. Maybe checking on that. And you can serve it. You can serve it and top it with picante sauce or some other hot sauce as you like it. This should make about 10 to 12 servings. So it sounds like a good, not only is it a mountain man-sized breakfast, but it's also good enough to serve, you know, 10 or 12 men and women. So it's a real good camp type breakfast recipe that sounds real delicious to me right now, and it's noon. You know?
It does. It sounds awesome. I was thinking, when you started the recipe, I was thinking, okay, you get all these ingredients, you throw it in there, you put the lid on, and you slow cook it. But so I was thrown for a loop there when you said, you know, brown this in one pan, and then you add this then, and then you add that then, and then you add this here, whatever. So I was a little discouraged when I started hearing all the different steps at different times. Because when I think Dutch oven, I kind of think like an old-fashioned crock pot where I can just add everything, put it in the oven, put it on the stove, put it on the heat, campfire, set it and forget it type of thing. But I guess every recipe is going to be a little different. That all the ingredients and what you just mentioned was fabulous. Who doesn't like any of that stuff? And it sounds good. So you just on that recipe, you just kind of have to add a little here, add a little there, cook this first, and then add it later. And so there's a little bit more steps to that recipe, though it does sound absolutely mouthwatering.
Yeah, yeah. There's really only the 30-minute cook, the 20-minute cook, and then a little cooking with the eggs in it. But it's really very, very easy, and that goes good. But let me run through the beans one.
Okay.
That's also a good quick recipe, and it's not as complicated. 32 ounces of canned beans. And, you know, this can be probably any kind, you know, people like pinto beans, they like navy beans, they like, you know, any kind of bean you like. A quarter cup of mustard, a quarter cup of ketchup, one chopped onion, 1/8 of a cup of cider vinegar, apple cider vinegar, and 1/2 cup of brown sugar, and then 4 slices of bacon. So you want to mix all the ingredients except for the bacon thoroughly, pour it into the oven, and put the bacon on top as full slices. Cover it and cook it for an hour at the 350-degree temperature, which, as I said, you can maintain by doing the coals correctly, as I said before, in the campfire. And when you, after that hour, when you remove the cover, everything should be done. It makes about 8 to 10 servings. I'm assuming, you know, if the bacon is not done by that time, you can always just throw them on another pan and just cook it to make sure. But I think an hour at 350 is going to be done. And the beans, of course, are going to be baked, you know, fabulously with all that stuff in it. And it's, you know, you couldn't think of anything easier. Everything's all one shot. And in it goes. An hour later, you come back. And, of course, you will be turning that oven on the campfire a quarter turn every 15 minutes and the lid being turned the opposite direction at the same time every 15 minutes. If you're outside, if you're on the stove, you may not need to do that, but you may want to anyway. So that's real simple. And then I think I've got time for one more.
Okay.
The cobbler, and I'll have to admit that I've never done this one, but I'm just going to basically tell you how it's done. You know, it's your, do this at your own hazard, I guess. It takes apple pie filling, one box of yellow cake mix. You take it from the box. I mean, if you want to make your own, that's fine, but this one calls for a box mix. And 1/2 can of 7-Up. This is a fizzy fruit cobbler. And 1 tablespoon of sweetening of cinnamon, actually. And you can experiment with this, but, you know, you might want to try cherry pie filling, in other words, some other, you know, berry, blueberry, whatever. But basically you line the oven with aluminum foil, that makes the cleanup a little easier. You pour your fruit filling into the bottom, sprinkle the cake mix on top, but you do not stir it. And then you pour your soda choice, the fizzy soda, on top of that. You don't really want to splatter it on here. You want to keep it low to the food so that it doesn't splatter around. And then you want to just mix the soda gently into the cake mix with a fork, just gently.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll sprinkle your cinnamon on top, and the whole shoot and match gets cooked at 325 degrees for about, it's 45 minutes at as close to 325 as you can get it. You will be able to, after 45 minutes, it'll just make sort of a cobbler out of it, and that should work. And like I said, I've never done this, but at that level, 45 minutes at that temperature sounds about right, and that should work just fine. And I do not know how many people this serves, but it sounds like it should handle, you know, at least 8. So
that's delicious. Wow. I could eat it all, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Once you get going, if you're hungry, it's just kind of.
Yeah, these recipes are all in. I've taken this out of our current issue. It's the July August issue of 2012, Back Home magazine. But we have had other issues. People can go online to our website and search our database. The website's backhomemagazine.com. There's a little icon there for searching our online database, and you can look up Dutch Oven or Dutch Oven Recipes. It'll bring up, we've had several good issues in the past with some excellent camp recipes and home stove recipes too, all sorts of things, pizza, baked beans, a variety of stews and meat dishes, desserts, breads, all sorts of stuff. And I've been through the magazine to find things that I could do, so I know they're there. But that's about it. I mean, the Dutch Oven is so versatile, and it is a little heavy. I mean, people may have to, if you have problems with arthritis or, clenching fingers or working with your hands like that, you may have to have help, somebody to help you move it when you're cooking, whatever. But other than that, it really is, with a little bit of prep going in and a little bit of care going out, just a few moments, it really is no more trouble than anything else, and it's great. It tastes a lot better than microwaving, I can tell you that.
Absolutely, and a lot healthier for you than any microwave food could ever be. But, wow, Richard, that is awesome. While you've been chatting, I've been online looking for Dutch ovens now. They're not cheap, are they? But they do last a lifetime. I mean, it's an investment that we're health about.
Yeah, I've seen them on sale here at our local hardware store for, $40, $45, but I don't know if the price is a lot more than that or whatever, but I have also seen them used in thrift stores and yard sales for $10, $15. So whatever.
That's
whatever
true.
Yeah,
that's true. Yard sales are wonderful. Even Goodwill and Habitat probably have some.
Yeah, Oh,
what
sure.
a wonderful
yeah.
history of this! To think they were actually part of our pioneer heritage. Traveling across the Great Plains with the pioneers and put on those campfires. What was it? Wishbone on the trail? What was it? Andy, wagon train.
Yeah.
Wagon train.
Train.
He must have had a Dutch oven on there.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us today. Great, great topic. A great follow-up from our show a few weeks ago about cast iron cooking. And I know that is labeled and marked in the archive. So, folks, if you missed that, it was a fabulous show. You can go to blogtalkradio.com and go to our show page and then just scroll down and try to find that show. I would say it was probably 2 or 3 months ago, and you can find that show on cast iron. This was a great follow-up, specifically, though, cooking with a specific cast iron item, the Dutch oven. So, Richard, I know you need to run. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your personal day today with the issues and being with us. We appreciate that, and we look forward to seeing you back here in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much, and we're sending prayers your way.
Okay, good deal, and good. Thank you, Pat and Andy, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks then. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Sounds great. Thank you. Bye-bye. All righty, let's take a little commercial break here, and then when we come back, Pat and I will have a little host chat, and we'll catch up with what's going on with her and her schedule and new books and things like that, and what's going on in the Chicken Whisperer world and the whole nine yards. We'll talk about the coop we're giving away tomorrow, woohoo, and a little bit of everything else. So we'll be back right after the short breaks, folks.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea, technology you can trust. Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
And you can find all the great Ware products here.
Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com.
It's easy and rewarding to keep backyard chickens, and My Pet Chicken can supply everything you need to get started, including baby chicks, chicken coops, accessories, books, and free how-to information, plus fun gifts and rooster decor. At My Pet Chicken, you can buy as few as 3 baby chicks. They also sell fertile hatching eggs. Visit them online at mypetchicken.com. That's mypetchicken.com. EggCartons.com, your discount supplier of egg cartons and poultry supplies. They carry a wide variety of egg cartons in paper, plastic, and foam, as well as a great selection of poultry supplies, including incubators, brooders, waterers, feeders, and more. Order online at eggcartons.com or call toll-free 1-888-852-5340. Free full-color catalog available. Be sure to sign up for their online newsletter for more great specials. That's eggcartons.com.
All right, thank you very much for staying with us. Just in case you were wondering, and I know you were, there are only 151 days, 11 hours, 22 minutes, and 30 seconds until Christmas. Thanks for staying with us, and I just knew we had people out there wondering how many days there were until Christmas. Pat, we could hear you singing in the background. Pat Foreman. I brought you back live. You might.
Yeah, I'm here,
but
that wasn't
there
me
go.
This time. That was you, because I know I go off key sometimes, and I didn't want to embarrass myself, especially with the Brocks.
All righty.
There
how
we
cool
do.
Is that?
You know, the
yeah, that was me. Yeah, it was. Yep.
Boy, I tell you, it's hot enough to think about Christmas and cool weather. Sounds pretty good right now.
I'm telling you what, man, this heat wave, this drought, they're talking about higher food prices next year because of the drought we're having out in the Midwest, really everywhere. But the Midwest here, we haven't had...
Not here.
Y'all have had plenty of rain?
We've had every afternoon, just about. We've had a thunder shower.
Wow, lucky
it's,
you.
It's uncommon. Yeah, it is really lucky. It couldn't be greener here in the Shenandoah Valley. It's just as beautiful green as you can imagine. But my heart goes out to the Midwest. You know, I'm from Indiana, and I talked to my mother. She says some farmers are just ruined. They're devastated. They won't even hardly get the corn stalks will be so dry. They won't be able to use them for much fodder either. So it's tough times. All the more reasons for backyard chickens. That's all I can say.
Yeah, backyard chickens, backyard gardens. But let me tell you, it's I'll go and I haven't even been in the garden yet. We got in late last night, about dark. I'll head down there today. May have to start the irrigation on it tonight to salvage a little bit that's still actually producing. Been very thankful, but that's okay because really in the next starting at least in 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, I need to start getting out there and haring it down, getting ready for the fall garden that we're going to plant. I want to try to get that in by September 15th and have it completely planted.
Fall.
So. Got to do that. Yeah.
Now, do you start some of your own seeds, Whisper, like for broccoli or a cabbage?
Have not geared up for that. We don't have a location for that. We've talked about putting in a cold frame or hot house, things to start that. But, you know, some things I have success with starting by seed. A lot I don't, especially the tomatoes, forget it. Forget it.
I've never had luck with that either. And others just get them to go like crazy. The brassicas, the cabbages, and the they're really hard to get to germinate in this heat.
Yeah.
Like they need colder weather just to sprout. So
easy
something
things.
To be aware of.
Like, you know, easy things to start from seed, your squash, your cucumber, your watermelon, pumpkin, things like
corn.
That. Maybe corn, beans, yeah. But some of these things
I'm
are just crazy.
Corn, but, yeah.
No, well, you can start scoring, yeah. So I'll get out there and try to deal with that. But still, you know how it is when you get in from 18-day trip, you know, laundry and this and that and catching up and going through mail and catching up on bills and things like that. But pretty crazy.
Email.
Hey, email. Tomorrow, Pat. We're giving away a chicken coop tomorrow, and we're very excited about that. We started this contest back on Monday, July 2nd. We started issuing passwords on Monday, July 2nd, and we only issue passwords Monday through Friday during the weekdays, so there have been 19 passwords issued and posted. And so they have been they were all posted on our Facebook. They were all posted and carried over to our Twitter account. And it's an awesome Snap Lock Chicken Coop from snaplockchickencoops.com. Go check them out. It's about a $450 value, and then it's shipped directly to your front door. No tools to put it together. It's, you know, it's awesome. And anybody would love to have this this coop for many reasons. But we're giving one away tomorrow, and so we have actually during the show today, I posted the secret password, the final secret password on our Facebook page. So they've all been posted and issued. So tomorrow, we'll start the show. It'll be Fun Friday. We'll give away some prizes from all of our sponsors, and then maybe halfway through the show, we'll get to the coop contest, and we'll take callers. Now, remember, the phone bank has 50 phone lines. 50 phone lines to choose from. So I don't know how many people have been collecting passwords out there, Facebook, Twitter, radio show, the whole nine yards. But if you call and get a busy signal, please call back. There'll be some people that will call in and then hang up or to get disconnected and try to call back. So but we got a bank of 50 phone lines, and so you know, definitely as soon as I say the contest is starting, we are going to now take caller number blank. Let's say caller number 41 right now at 347-637-3237. This will be tomorrow if you happen to be caller number 41, and we bring you live, and you can recite all 19 secret passwords, then you're going to win this awesome chicken coop from snaplockchickencoops.com. And so we will have that winner tomorrow, and then once the coop's given away, then we'll probably have a few more little contests that we'll be doing tomorrow's radio show as well. So it's going to be a great show tomorrow. Very excited about that. And just give you an update. I promised you I'd keep you updated on the possible the Discovery Network television show. The producer that contacted me a couple of months ago, wanting to talk to people who pamper their pets, including chickens. She has recontacted me a few days ago, inquiring about a show or a season of a possible Chicken Whisperer show about, again, the backyard poultry movement, traveling, trying to – now, again, very, 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 very preliminary. I don't know if she wants to do more of a show about homestead, moving from the city to the country, and incorporate the Chicken Whisperer into that, or just Chicken Whisperer, or just homestead living. I don't know. But I've got a conference call with her later this afternoon, and so I'm looking very much forward to that. Like I tell folks, I said, not getting my hopes up. If it pans out, great. It'll be a blessing. If it doesn't, I'm still blessed to have the best job in the world and living my dream here on the homestead with a wonderful family. So it's, you know, if it happens, great. If it doesn't, great. I'm just thrilled that they're communicating with me. This is about the third or fourth, maybe fifth time that this has happened. And this TV producer gets it, and she's interested. Ones before have wanted people that actually communicate with chickens back and forth. I said, no, I'm not your man. They wanted some type of wow factor, Jerry Springer-style drama chicken show, and I'm like, no, I'm not your man. This is serious stuff. This is an important movement. It's, you know, food in your backyard. It's, you know, composting. It's, you know, it's spreading the country. It's spreading the world. And I want the combination, kind of a Martha Stewart / This Old House show. That's my theory of doing educational about, you know, setting up backyard coops, all the benefits, doing some troubleshooting, fighting City Hall and things like that. Maybe they can follow us on the tour. So we'll just have to see what actually happens with that. May not pan out at all. I may come back on and say, well, we didn't really come to an agreement. They wanted something different than I was willing to offer, or maybe they just didn't see the wow factor. But I'm telling you, when we don't have a TV in the house, so that'll be interesting. I'll have to go to my neighbor's house to watch my own TV show if that pans out. But when we're in the hotel room, rooms, and we happen to turn the boob tube on, I see some of these shows. Me and Jen just look at each other and just roll our eyes, and I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. Here's something that I think that we could do very – very good very educational and do have a great benefit to the people who keep backyard poultry or needing to change the laws and things like that. And we look at each other and we see shows that, you know, an hour-long TV show about people getting parking tickets, or an hour-long TV show about there's a new one coming up that we just looked at the previews for. Just, I'm like, are you kidding me? There's a show about my uncle told me about it, a bait car. You know, they leave a car with the keys in it running and hope somebody will steal it. And then when they steal it, they shut it down with LoJack or something, and then they arrest the guy. So, I mean, people are watching these shows. It's
human race
serious
must rise above this towards more noble endeavors and efforts.
So, you know, I'm not knocking any of those shows, but I'm thinking if people are watching the show, my uncle said, hey, Andy, you got to watch a show. We were visiting him. Hey, you got to watch a show. We turned it on a network, and there was a show about this dude that the episode I saw, he was walking through a pond barefoot and finding snapper turtles. And so I'm like, you know, that's –
well,
I'm serious.
Sure, I've been in the gene pool very long, will I?
I'm like, okay. I mean, hey, that's all good, man. He's doing a service. Here's this church used this pond to baptize folks, and they went to go baptize somebody, and they got nipped on the ankle by this snapping turtle, and they called this guy, and he goes out, and he walks barefoot through this pond to find a snapping turtle. So I'm like, okay, if he can have a show, then you know, there should be a good educational show about sustainability and backyard chickens, and we can make this happen if we can kind of if we get the right person to call and knows about the movement. And so I'll keep you posted on that, not holding my breath, but if it happens, then we'll see what happens. So more power to the Discovery Channel if they choose to jump on this and make it happen. So I promise I'll make it respectful and entertaining, but educational as well. So we got that going on. The coop, chicken coop tomorrow. Let me look at next week as we. I just can't believe it. Next week we get into August. August, Pat. I can't believe it.
Oh, I can't either. I'm not ready for the summer to end.
Tomorrow, next week's episodes will be a little different, maybe, because it's fifth weekdays. Normally, we take a break and don't do shows on the fifth days of the month, like the fifth Monday, the fifth Tuesday. But since we were just, again, on a vacation slash tour and didn't have a few shows, I'm going to work to make sure we do have shows all next week. But it looks like we've got the fifth Monday let's see, is it the fifth Monday and the fifth Tuesday, I believe, coming up this week. So I'll try to get some guests to fill that. And then we've got the first Wednesday will be Garden Wise Living with Arlena, it looks like, on the first. And then the second, it looks like Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD in poultry scientist, and then a fun Friday. So I think I'll be able to, I even have a couple in mind for Monday and Tuesday show of next week, because it will it'll be the fifth weekday, so not a problem there. So, but make sure you tune in tomorrow. We'll have, again, I'll try to open the chat room a little early tomorrow, because I know a lot of people will be wanting to get in. Always do when we get giveaway coops. We'll have people that maybe can't listen all the time, but they can, hey, try to win a coop and listen in. So I'll try to get the chat room open early, because sometimes with a bunch of people trying to get into the chat room, it gets blocked, or the computer just spins and spins and spins and won't let you in. So I'll try to open up the chat room about 30 minutes early tomorrow for all your folks. Pat, give us an update on what you've been doing the last couple of weeks, and any classes, any book signings that you're doing, any events that you're doing.
I'll mention too,
I think the next time you and I will be together actually will be coming up in November at the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy Annual Conference in Cary, North Carolina, just outside of Raleigh. And we'll be up there, and I'm looking forward to that. Have you heard for a fact that Steve Pope's going to be there or not?
Well, I believe he is. Last time I heard, he talked with him. He was planning to do it, but knowing Steve, he'll show up. It's one of his favorite.
I hope so
to go.
Because I'm bringing him a case. I'm bringing him a case of Italian dressing.
Oh dear.
So.
Oh no!
I want to see if he can incorporate that in a nice recipe for us while we're up there. So I look forward to seeing Steve Pope and everybody else. All these true chicken experts that I'm going to look forward to meeting. All these expert breeders and authors, and I'm just really excited to meet all these great folks that have done and are doing so much for ALBC and the backyard and the sustainability thing. So tell us about what you've been up to, Pat. What you're doing? What's in your future?
Well, I got to tell you, you referred me to the Virginia Planners Association.
Yeah,
it's the Association of City Planners, the Virginia chapter. And I went over to Wintergreen, Virginia, and gave two workshops on consecutive days. And the chicken workshops were packed. It was absolutely fabulous. And I took Oprah Henfrey with me. She was a co-presenter. So, of course, a lot of them had never even seen a live chicken, much less petted one. So that was a big hit. And they let me set up out at the registration center, Oprah and I, to just kind of greet people. And they're coming in. They're saying, oh, my God, it's a chicken. Have you ever petted a chicken before? No. Oh, they're so soft. I mean, I must have heard that a couple hundred times. I can't believe she's so soft. So that was a great, great time. And then Monday, I got a call from the Virginia City, from Richmond, Richmond City Planner, and they're up against the wall, and they want to, you know, they're talking about chickens. It's really hot here in the East Coast about chickens in different cities. And so we're going to be working with them, getting some information about how they can make it work in Richmond. So that was a great experience for me. Thank you for that referral. Really appreciate it. And I think it's going to have some ramifications that will just sort of spread out. Yeah. And then last weekend, the 21st and 22nd, I was up at the Vignette Day Lily Food and Wine Festival. Oh, man, was that really nice. And Oprah and I went up there, too, and just met some wonderful people. I tasted just a little bit of wine. I don't like to drink before I do any presentations, and one of mine was at the end of the day, so I didn't get any at all because they stopped serving at 5:30 for the ABC laws. But that's a huge event, and I hadn't realized it was so big and so well attended, and it was just so much fun.
When you were at that thing at the Virginia meeting, did anybody come up and say you've changed my mind or now I see I can see this. I can see us allowing this now. Or thank you for giving me the facts and eliminating all that stuff. So.
Yep, the response was incredibly positive. just absolutely incredibly positive. In fact, one came up, one lady said she at the very first workshop, there were a lot of people attended both workshops. They were different workshops. One was the seven myths of urban chickens, and then the other one was the Chicken Have More Plan, you know, how they really enable communities and,
awesome.
And save taxpayer dollars and all that sort of stuff. So she came up after the second one. She says, I'm gonna just secretly give your email to my boss, but you can't let him know it's from me because I want to get behind the chicken campaign, but do it a little more secretly, so it has a little more impact. And she was totally against it at the very first session. She said, well, my neighbor had chickens, and their chickens came up on my porch, and I just really didn't like that. And I said, mm-hmm. Well, I can understand that, but afterwards,
yeah, you
she
say,
said,
well, then
I want my own flock now, is what she wants.
Yeah, well, then your neighbor was doing it wrong because, you know, we don't advocate that 100%. I wouldn't want my neighbor's chickens on my porch pooping all over it when I go out there to read the paper and I'm stepping in chicken poo and then I track it in my house. Absolutely not. I mean, that neighbor needs to be scalded and needs to, you know, be...
It was just a couple of chickens that got out. It's not a routine. It wasn't a routine thing with her. It was just a couple. But she was afraid of them because she'd never touched a chicken before. And all of a sudden, here's this, you know, relatively large bird, just a standard bird, is what, maybe six to 8 pounds, you know, up on her deck. And she just didn't know have any chicken experience, so she didn't know what to do. But after petting Oprah, she did. So anyway, it was great fun. Just great fun.
That's fabulous. I'm so
glad.
Yeah,
they are coming up. And the early, we're still working on it, but I'm pleased to announce that the chickensandyou.com website is up. It's chickensandyou spelled out .com, and it's got the courses all listed out. And we'll be we're putting together an online schedule to start pretty soon in the next month or so to be giving courses online. So that was a really good thing to offer, where they can see that we can literally go into cities and even hold a workshop for a whole city or for the police department, whatever, and get their chicken skills absolutely, you know, the learning curve straight up, so they're good to go with humane and sanitary and profitable chickens, family chickens or whatever. So that's moving forward very quickly. I'm thrilled to say that. The website's not done yet, but it's at least it's up and it's got a lot of information on there. We're going to be expanding it with a lot of legal stuff for cities to ponder. You know, the ideal code that we've talked about so much, and of course the seven myths and that sort of thing.
I'm there now looking at it. Looks really, really, really good. So we will...
At least it comes up. For a while, we couldn't even get it to publish. It was like, that was just it. So, yeah. So that's coming along. It's fun working on it, but it's so tedious. Gosh. And then I don't have anything really scheduled until September. That's when the Mother Earth Fair at
Pennsylvania.
The Mother Earth yes, it's in Pennsylvania, Seven Springs, and that'll be on the 21st and the 22nd, and then I'm going to be speaking at the Monticello Heritage Festival. And that's the weekend before, on the 14th and the 15th. So those are my next sort of big conferences, big festivals kind of things. So a couple of workshops, but we'll see. So how about you? That's sort of what my life has been.
After this, I'm we'll
you're
be
back.
To,
you're getting
yeah, done. we got to go to Atlanta next week for an overnight trip for to Jen do some training with professional development and pre planning for her school year. But so that'll be a couple of days up in Atlanta next week. But other than that, we should be here for the duration until October. We may, I take that back. I may be heading up to Tractor Supply and talk and negotiate with them a little bit. So that may, in the next 30 to 60 days, a trip up to near Nashville to talk with Tractor Supply. They're looking at good dates for me to go up there and talk with them about a premier sponsorship and then to sponsor our tours. And then maybe we just might and continue what we did this time in October/November up towards the Northeast. So
so, or maybe we incorporate a week-long or 10-day tour around the time we have the ALBC and stop there at the ALBC and then work our way up towards the Northeast.
There
and,
you go.
So we'll see
Absolutely.
What happens there. But other than that, well, all righty, Pat, thank you very much for joining us today. And I don't know your schedule if you're being in the pharmacy tomorrow, but if you're not, you can come and join us and give away this awesome chicken coop tomorrow.
Okay, great. We'll do. I never know. Sometimes I get called
right.
at the last minute. So, but
that's fine.
But
just
it's all
let
fun.
Me know.
Yeah.
If you're there on the switchboard, I'll bring you on. If you're not, we'll say you're
Thank
in the pharmacy.
You.
And if not, then you have a fabulous weekend. And we'll be back here on Monday with actually, Monday will be Peter Brown, the chicken doctor. So I already know for a fact that we'll have that on Monday.
Excellent.
Even though it's the fifth Monday, he agreed to do that. So this coming Monday. So then that just leaves Tuesday open. The rest of the day week will be filled with broadcasts. So thanks so much, and we'll see you maybe tomorrow. If not, then on Monday, Pat. Take care.
Yeah, and I bet everybody's going to go out and buy Dutch ovens. I wouldn't be surprised.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, Pat, why don't you just go ahead and take it away? We'll call it a show.
Okay, great. Thanks, Whisper. Well, of course, Richard Frudenberger was our very special guest today talking about Dutch ovens. Richard is the publisher and the technical writer for Back Home Magazine, and you can see their magazine at www.backhomemagazine.com. Thanks to all our chat room chicken ears, of course, and all our listeners for tuning in and listening along. And blogtalkradio.com provides our radio, chat, and the video services. Andy Schneider, the traveling chicken whisperer, is the creator of the show. And, of course, the wind beneath our wings, which is why we can fly so far. I'm Pat Forman, and on behalf of all of us, may the flock be with you, quote the chicken, evermore. God bless everybody. Oh,